Hello again and welcome to the podcast, the podcast about Poland and English. My name is Anna, I am a Pole living in London, and I normally co-host this show with my friend Eva. However, this episode is slightly different. It was actually recorded back in January when I originally thought of starting this podcast on my own. You will hopefully see that both sound quality and my interviewing skills have somewhat improved since then, and the style has changed a bit. But regardless of the technical imperfections, I thought that there is enough interesting content here that is worth releasing. This episode focuses on the humanitarian crisis on the border between Poland and Belarus, which made international headlines last summer. For those who haven't followed, let me briefly recap the story. So as a response to fresh sanctions imposed on Belarus last spring, President Lukashenko threatened to flood Europe with migrants. And last summer, we heard first reports of people arriving through Belarus at the Polish border, as well as in Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia. These are people who were lied to, that if they arrived this way, they would be allowed to stay in the EU. But instead, they were met with pushbacks and brutality on both sides of the border, stuck and unable to move. The Polish government announced a state of emergency, restricting the access of journalists and humanitarian aid to the area. And we started hearing numerous reports of people dying at the border from cold, starvation, and lack of medical care. And since then, the news cycle has largely moved on, but that doesn't mean that the crisis is over. Migrants who reach Poland, including disabled people and parents with small children, are still being forcibly deported back to Belarus. And according to an update I got from Paulina, there's still around 150 people, mostly very vulnerable, stumbling around the border area. So the problem is ongoing, and the conversation that you'll be hearing this episode remains relevant. It also seems like a useful follow-up from our episode about Ukraine, where we talked about the response to Ukrainian refugees arriving in Poland. Playing these different groups of migrants against each other has been a major feature of right-wing discourse in recent weeks, with the Territorial Defense Force, responsible for the pushbacks, posting openly racist memes about the difference between refugees, presented as grateful white Ukrainian grandmas and immigrants represented by brown men. And activists involved in supporting migrants on the Belarusian border have faced criminal charges. So without further ado, let's move on to our conversation. To discuss the border crisis, I invited Paulina Olszanka to tell us more about what has happened and what the situation currently is. And we'll also try to situate it in a broader context. Paulina is a writer who reports on Poland from a critical perspective. She has written about the border crisis for both the Polish and the international press and has been in direct contact with a number of migrants and heard their stories firsthand. Thank you so much for joining us, Paulina.
So let's start by talking about the timeline of the current crisis. I heard the first reports about refugees trying to reach Poland through Belarus in August 2021. Soon after the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban. Was this actually when the crisis started?
That's when the crisis became sort of more apparent on a media scale. I wouldn't say that the two events are actually connected. We know that obviously Afghanistan collapsed and the Taliban invaded, and Poland was one of those countries that issued assistance and flew Afghan citizens out to Poland, but this was actually an entirely separate phenomenon to what was happening on the border. In fact, people had already been crossing the border for a few months beforehand, but it became an issue when there was a sort of standoff around a group of about 20 migrants in around August in Usnashogorno, which is when it became sort of more visible on an international scale. And that's where you sort of started to see this tension between, the two sides of the European Union, right? So the pushback side and the one which is supposed to be honoring, European values. So you had, activists there, you had the police, you had the border guards, and then you had a media presence and a standoff for about 2 weeks, where you had activists trying to cross over and help various migrants, and then obviously the police not letting them do that. And then, it became a more intense sort of crisis until the Polish government, started to take, action. You know, you had this first initial situation, then you had the state of emergency initiated, then you had this more visible sort of Kurdish group camped out on the Belarusian-Polish border, which ended up sort of creating a bit of a sort of geopolitical crisis because it was creating tension between Belarus and the European Union, and then it sort of de-escalated. And since then, I mean, the media attention has been drawn away from the situation, but we still have people wandering through the forest, so in between Belarus and Poland, particularly in this zone between the two. There's this kind of a zone between where they get pushed back by Polish soldiers and they get pushed back by Belarusian soldiers. It's a few kilometers long, and so they tend to spend a lot of time in this space.
So do we know how many people have been affected by this and how many people are still there now?
In terms of figures, well, you know, the journalists can't actually verify figures. That's one of the more ridiculous things in this, is that we don't actually have access to them, anything. We know that, I think one of the ministries in Poland said a couple of weeks ago that there were still about 2,000 or 3,000 migrants in Belarus, but a lot of them do actually go back to Minsk, because now the Belarusian border guards are actually releasing them and letting them go back, because for a while they weren't actually letting them retreat back to Minsk. So I had a couple of Kurds contacting me I think a week ago, and they were in a barn somewhere in Poland, and suddenly the next day they'd been pushed back and they were back in Minsk. But they had actually been in Belarus for 3 months now, which suggests, and they said that they don't really know anyone new that's coming through. And none of the people that I know in the camps in Germany who are receiving migrants have noticed anyone new coming into Belarus in the last few months. So it looks like people who are still there are the ones that are still languishing there. They've been there for a few months rather than there being new people coming in from Iraq or Syria. This is a different crisis to the one a few months ago, because a few months ago they were being instrumentally used to sort of push against the border, right? So they were, the Belarusian border guards weren't letting migrants go back deeper into Belarus. But they have Belarusian visas, and so actually a lot of them do have the opportunity of going back to like a bigger city in Belarus, waiting it out and trying it again. And then the question is to which degree people are actually given the opportunity to leave and go back to their country of origin, or not their country of origin in terms of citizenship, because many of them actually don't come from there, don't arrive from there, but even just the country of origin from where they flew from, right? So it's a kind of the nature of the beast keeps changing, because before, you know, it was a really critical humanitarian crisis in the sense that they really, 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 really were physically trapped and were being deliberately denied food and deliberately denied water. And now it's not fully clear to which degree, you know, they can actually find some sort of shelter in Belarus, pay for a hotel or something like that, and then try and cross the border again. That's not fully clear.
Right, that's really interesting what you're saying. As someone who's been in touch with migrants currently at the border, can you explain their stories? I mean, who are these people? Where are they from? How do they find themselves in a situation?
I'm mainly in contact with Kurds. They normally come from northern Iraq, but there are people from Syria. There are, well, people that have been languishing in camps for like half of their lives in Turkey. There are people who come from, you know, wealthy families, and there are people that come from very, very dire conditions. Most of the people I spoke to are, like, you know, 20-year-old boys, because obviously those are the people, they're the strongest type of people who can leave. And they all just say, you know, they were terrified, like they really thought they were dying, and I was speaking to them, and speaking to these boys who have had to, like, you know, mature in this particular way, like, you know, to think that they're going to die for weeks is really awful. They just say that they just want to work because there's no work they've come from. There's no future where they've come from. You know, they come from Kurdistan where they don't have even the representation they would like, which was taken over by, because they're from Mosul, right? So, you know, these were ISIS strongholds. Very, you know, very poor very poor places. Other people have been languishing in camps in other parts of the Middle East for a very long time. And, you know, this was their, these decisions don't come lightly. And they thought that this was, you know, their opportunity to make a better life for themselves. And, you know, what they had to go through in the last few months is really quite shocking. And, you know, you wouldn't wish that on anyone. One of the saddest things about this crisis is because it was sold, you know, many of the ways in which these people got into Poland, into Belarus was where they were sort of tricked into thinking it was just like a really easy route into Poland. So actually a lot of people sent their sick family members. So, you know, people that needed, you know, treatment for epilepsy or treatment for diabetes, without being able to make the proper risk assessment, because this was obviously a new route and nobody knew that they were being sort of used instrumentally by Lukashenko. So you're seeing a lot of people who they sold everything, right, to go to for treatment in Germany. Like, that's something I've heard a few times, that kind of thing. A lot of them are economic migrants. A lot of them have family who've been killed by ISIS, right? So it's a lot of these are the direct legacy of colonialism. And of course there are Afghans there too, but the thing is that the Afghans and one other group are the ones that tend to get asylum immediately because they are seen as actually, you know, at risk. So you don't actually see them coming up so often in those conversations or in those reports, simply because when they do actually issue those applications, they, from what I understand, they tend to be honored more than not. And I think there's one other at-risk group that also receives asylum fairly easily.
I remember from the early days, the Polish right was using the term hybrid warfare. Accusing Belarus of waging a hybrid war. Can you explain a little bit about what that means?
This whole thing just escalated very quickly. So at the beginning, I was telling you about this Ulsan Bordemir, where, you know, you just had 20 refugees and then you had a whole group of, you know, media representatives and activists and obviously cops and the like. And, you know, suddenly we had a state of emergency and suddenly there was a hybrid war. And, you know, technically it's a correct term. It's referring to a sort of like non-conventional forms of warfare. If you're trying to, you know, encroach on someone's sovereignty, you know, these are all things that we can obviously equivocate over. But you know, that you could make an argument for these people, for these migrants being used instrumentally to create unrest, right? And to, you know, cause problems. I don't know. Like, I think that's what they mean. It's like, you know, it's a geopolitical term in terms of, you know, someone's sovereignty being encroached upon, I think. And part of that is also that it's happening, It's not happening through literal force. It's happening in this way, but also that, you know, there's disinformation campaigns. You know, a lot of this stuff is happening online. You get a lot of like trolls, create like, you know, Russian based trolls, but, you know, from all sides of the story, right? Like all over the shop. Trolls that are sort of instigating, a lot of the sort of like, deep, darker rhetoric. So I think this is what they mean by hybrid warfare. But obviously within a domestic context, it was also necessary for the Polish state to have some sort of like emboldened language, which it loves.
Right. And before we talk more about the response of the Polish state, I'll come back to this in a second. I'm sort of curious how all this essentially human trafficking operation worked in practice, like where people were being approached online to come to Europe, in person, like how does it work?
It tends to have been through word of mouth. So your friend says something that, you know, and then there's something that's recommended and it gets shared on social media. And these are actually legitimate parts, like they do exist. You do have a travel agent who does issue these visas and does create these, you know, these package tours. They tend to be like $3,000 or $4,000 or something, which is a lot of money. And, you know, it's an all-inclusive kind of thing. You get flown out from a country of origin, for example, like Iraq, and then, or Turkey, or Lebanon, and then you end up in, Minsk, often via Moscow.
Right. Now I want to talk a little bit more about the Polish government's response. I mean, I remember from the early days of first reports coming in, of migrants arriving at the border, the Lower Justice government responded with ramping up racism, nationalism, xenophobia. You remember this ludicrous story of a government minister trying to fake evidence of migrants allegedly filming child porn and bestiality on their phones, when actually it turned out to be a clip from some like old porn film that was widely available online. Like, what was that about?
That situation where they went through some migrants' phones, and these were not even migrants or refugees who were at the border. These were people who had already been in Poland for a while in the camps. And there was some photo of a bestiality photo, right? And they'd just taken it off the camera and they'd projected it onto some, you know, PowerPoint in a government briefing and said that this is what these migrants are doing. They're basically, you know, having sex with animals. But the whole thing, like, was so farcical and so ridiculous that really, like, I don't know what effect it actually had, because, they've even identified the wrong animal. And then even, I think the minister who was briefing them, or sort of, you know, was adjacent to his briefing, had actually had a parliamentary inquiry into whether he had made out with a dog at a party a few years earlier. So, yeah, so the whole thing just became this absolute joke of a political situation. But the fact is that is something. The stoking of fear and resentment is absolutely very present. I mean, just using the language of war absolutely terrifies people. I remember that when I was there on the border, they had just issued stay-at-home decrees for children, so the children didn't actually have to go to school. That's when learning was offline again, and they said that the children in the border area can go back to learning online because of the risk of because of the state of emergency and because of the risky situations with people crossing the border. Like, I mean, you know, if that's what you're seeing from the media and from the government, like, this, yeah, definitely. It felt like we were in the middle of a war, absolutely. But it wasn't fully clear what the war was.
And then more recently, we saw a spectacle of that gig when celebrities were invited to sing in honor and solidarity with the Polish border force, right?
Yeah, so like Murem za Mundurem, which is like, I guess you could roughly translate as, you know, we've got the backs of the military, right? There's a war, we're holding a wall against the military, behind the military. It doesn't translate well, but we've got your backs, basically. And there was this whole rhetoric that the people who we really had to, you know, make soup for were not the people that were starving and freezing in the bushes, but the hardworking military on the border. I mean, the Bank of Poland issued a commemorative coin. So this is in the context of, like, you know, astronomically growing inflation in Poland. They issued a commemorative coin, which said something about, like, protecting Poland's, you know, eastern border. So that's what the central bank is focused on. Poland's very good at the symbolic over the practical. So that's what was happening on that level. But also, like, yeah, but also that concert, there was this concert for, it was televised, of course, because they got, like, I think Lou Bega and, like, Last Ketchup, like, you know, '90s band, the only bands that you would probably get to play at this concert. The whole thing was a spectacle. It had nothing to do with the soldiers themselves.
A little of that kind of nationalist fear-mongering rhetoric is not new. I mean, it feels very familiar. It's easy to forget that when Law and Justice got first elected in 2015, it was on the wave of anti-refugee sentiment and a campaign based around opposition to extending refugees, right? And for the first few years of the government, I remember refugees, migrants, Muslims, foreigners, and so on being blamed for every problem facing Europe. Whereas the more recent years, that was replaced by LGBT people as the main enemy, overtaken by debates around women's rights, abortion rights, and so on. But now, like, that 2015 rhetoric seems to be coming back to an extent. Like, I was sort of wondering, like, what similarities and differences do you see between what's happening now in 2015 in terms of the Polish response?
I think overwhelmingly what was different about this situation was that it was happening, like, it, something was actually happening in Poland, right? And it was coming from the East, and it was coming, and we weren't fully clear to which degree Russia was involved. Like, I think that war rhetoric became a much bigger thing than the individual rhetoric around refugees or migrants. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I had one friend, like, well, you just stop speaking to each other because he just kind of like, he's fairly conservative, but you know, you wouldn't know it on a normal day. But he just like sort of lost his mind, but it wasn't fully clear when he was arguing with me what he was scared of, whether he was scared of the Russians, because he was sort of like moving between the conversation about Russians. And then, also with the refugees, but then he was also conflating that with, you know, I don't even know the people who are living in my apartment building anymore. So then you've got the transparent, you've got a deeply sort of like neoliberal environment where you have a lot of people coming through for work, like Poles have elsewhere. So the exact same situation as you would have had in the UK. But so he was conflating this man who was speaking a different language in his apartment building and how he was upset with this man because he was speaking too loudly on his phone. And he was conflating that with the people on the border and also what Russia's up to, right? So, you know, it's not hard in Poland to immediately escalate to a mentality of feeling, you know, under siege. So that is what I would say is like, you know, is different about the situation. So that I think people, I think most people unequivocally feel like, you know, it's a black or white matter, this situation with the border, right? But I think that's also because it's a border and it's the East. And I think it's been conflated with a lot of other traumas there.
And what is the public opinion on this currently? Like, are you mostly with the government, against the government on this issue? Like, how is civil society responding?
I think it's like a 50-50 thing. I haven't looked at the figures lately, but definitely Law and Justice did gain, you know, some voters on the back of that, and especially at a time when, you know, everything else that they've been doing is just going wrong, and they're really facing a lot of flack. You know, gas prices are just growing and electricity prices are growing, but nevertheless they part of it because of their political economy. Like, their political economy is an absolute joke, and you know, as much as I agree with it from a leftist perspective, in some ways, like, it's an ideological project. It's not an economic project. Therefore, it's a complete mess. So they're trying to just, so, you know, that nevertheless, despite all of those things, they've managed to sort of, you know, gain momentum, and gain support from the Polish public. But then you've also got this completely other side of the picture where you have, like, everybody I know, apart from, you know, one or two of these people who are totally freaked out, like, everybody I know has done something for the people on the border. Like, they've either gone there physically, they have donated money, they have donated food, they've donated clothes, they are reporting on it. They're basically anything that you could do in your spare time. It's like this major mobilization of civic society, which is more in line with that sort of like solidarity tradition and that sort of emancipatory tradition. And also, like, Poland is so good at, you know, reactivating its sort of like underground state networks. It takes like 2 seconds and then, you know, everyone's crawling through the bushes and, you know, people are like hiding people in their basement, in the same basement that their grandparents were hiding Jews in during World War II. So there's major division, which I think this is the first time I really fully understood just how Poland is polarized. Like, I wasn't always it has always been polarized, but it wasn't something I ever looked at in that. Like, I never framed things in that way. Like, some journalists tend to, you know, they choose how they frame the thing, right? And I never really chose to frame things in terms of things being polarized. But yeah, but this is one of those situations where you're really dealing with two entirely different ideas of what it is to be Polish. So one of them is to be hospitable, to show Europe, like, how to be European. Like, we are better than Europe. We uphold European values better than the rest of you do. And then the other one, which is like, well, we're protecting Europe and we're protecting Europeanness and we're protecting, I don't know, like, I don't know what, you know, freedom or sovereignty or whatever, you know, everything's co-opted.
Well, yeah, I mean, Polish hospitality is something we claim to be proud of as a nation. Like, there is this Polish tradition where at Christmas Eve table, every family is meant to leave one empty plate for an unexpected guest in case a stranger comes in. And, you know, most Polish homes have it, but there was polling done around, like, how many families will actually accept a refugee who wanted to come for dinner. And obviously responses were very polarized across political lines, across cultural and religious practices and values.
Sure. Wow, I didn't see that. That would have been, I have to look that up. No, that sounds amazing. Yeah, no, but nevertheless, like that emerged symbolically within the rhetoric, right? So people were saying, this Christmas Eve, I'm going to be setting up a plate and dedicating it to the refugee in the forest. But then you're right, like that's somebody that actually won't actually physically come to your house. So it still remains on the level of symbolism, like much does.
Right, yeah, I mean, like, obviously the polling is at the level of declaration what people say they would do. But actually, we've also seen that, like, in the border area, a lot of people did organize to support migrants. When journalists were not allowed, when NGOs were banned, a lot of people did kind of come together to help, right?
When the state of emergency was announced, after that sort of those initial skirmishes at the border with activists and journalists and refugees and police and border guards, like, there was just a blanket state of emergency across the border with Belarus, which means that only people who have a pass can enter that zone, and you really only can have a pass if you're either, you know, working for, you know, the forces, someone, you know, either the police or the military or the border guards, and or you're a local. So that's theoretically, those are the only people that are allowed there. NGOs, like, officially are not allowed in there. Activists are not allowed in there. Media representation is not allowed in there, like, in the middle of European Union. So, like, that's something that's quite shocking, because even, like, in some of the worst war zones, you still get, media representation, and that sometimes is fully respected by military forces. But in the middle of the European Union, we can't actually execute our duties. So you have this Grupa Granica, so the border group, which is a sort of a group made up of a number of different smaller volunteering groups that, you know, who all started working there around the same time, and they decided it was better just to work together in a more centralized way. And what they do officially is that they administer help. So if you have someone crossing the border, they will somehow receive a notification that this person is somewhere. They will receive a PIN notification about their exact location, even if it's within the border itself, the border zone that's where the state of emergency is in place. And they will descend on that area and give them food, give them water, give them clothes, and, you know, power packs and things like that. Like, you obviously can't drive them anywhere, you can't take them anywhere, because you will be charged with smuggling. However, you know, the law is obviously very murky. So on the one hand, like, there's no reason why you can't actually allow people to enter your house, because there's no law in Poland that says that you need to check someone's documents, check their identity before they enter your house, right? So there isn't necessarily, you know, cause to say that someone's a smuggler just because someone is in their house. But, you know, but we live in Poland now, in a country that is at war with the European Union and the European Commission, and, you know, it's not clear whether you would actually receive a fair trial anymore. So people can't risk, you know, they can't bluff in terms of what the law will or will not do with you. So, you know, but people do that nevertheless. But, you know, I'm just trying to sort of paint how murky this space is. And so Grupa Granica administers a lot of help. And, like, I mean, they've been doing this since August or September, and so that's half a year. And they give people new clothes. They give them new stuff. Everything is new. And that's all volunteer stuff. That's all stuff that has been given by volunteers from different parts of Poland. So just to think about that sheer volume to have consistently, you know, 6 months worth of stuff. And, you know, there was a while there where you were getting like, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 different calls every day where people were, you know, looking for refugees in the bushes. So that's a lot of stuff. And yeah, and so that, you know, so you have people that descend on, and then they often ask for media presence when they think that border guards are going to arrive and border guards are going to turf them back over into Belarus. So they want to make sure that there's media presence to show, you know, how basically the right for asylum is not being respected. The due process for asylum is not being respected. And particularly in cases where people are very ill and very sick. This Grupa Granica, so the border group, and Ocalenia is another organization. They absolutely need to ensure that there's some sort of media coverage to make sure that, that, you know, some sort of basic human rights are respected. Like recently there was a situation that I was tweeting about with a 16-year-old, a boy with epilepsy who had crossed the border into Poland and had been thrown over again with only like two pills, for his epilepsy. And one of the other journalists, I think Krzysztof Boczek, spoke to a neurologist who said that, I mean, once those pills stop working, and that will be within 12 hours, he only has like half an hour in the cold temperatures to survive. So we had to put a lot of pressure and make a lot of noise around looking for him and securing his safety, and then the border guards ended up giving him the right to apply for asylum. So, you know, it's, yeah, that was definitely a situation where it looked like media pressure really, really helped. But, you know, so that's what they do. Like they are basically responsible for, they are the state, you know, they are the ones that make sure people get through, they are the ones that make sure people get legal representation, they are the ones who make sure that people get medical help, they're the ones who you know, make sure they're basically not dying. They're the ones that collect their details. Like, if you're pushing people back, you're not people yet. They don't have identities yet. So, you know, people die in the forest and you don't know who they are.
Yeah, I think Grupa Granica and Fundacja Ocalenia really deserve credit for the work they've done on the border. I remember in the early days, it was through the tweets of Fundacja Ocalenia that people knew and the media knew about what's actually happening, right? They were the ones who were in contact with people and tweeting about families being ill, people like not having enough food, not having medical care, and really kind of shining light on what's happening. But those people who arrived 5-6 months ago, I'm wondering what's happening to them now. I mean, you've mentioned that some of them have actually managed to get asylum. Do we know how many people have managed to get asylum in the EU?
No. I mean, the last number I had was like 10,000 people had, 10,000 people had entered Germany via the Polish route and had applied for asylum. That doesn't mean received asylum, applied for asylum. But then also we need to keep in mind, like, I think Germany, deported a whole bunch of people recently, but I don't know if it's the same ones who crossed the border. No, I don't know. This is something that I would like to find out. We're not going to get the figures from Poland anytime soon about how many people, have attempted to apply for asylum in Poland or who have applied for asylum successfully and who have received asylum successfully. Right. I don't think we're going to be able to get those figures anytime soon.
Something you mentioned at the beginning, but which we haven't talked about in detail yet, is the role of the EU. I mean, what part has the EU played in all this?
So, you know, one of the things when we're reporting on this issue, because you know, it looks like Poland's doing the big bad thing again that Poland likes to do, but this is EU policy. Like, EU policy, I mean, I think even a few weeks ago, the Commission was mooting a law which would actually allow, you know, some sort of, you know, judicial space or judicial room for actually allowing for pushbacks, because pushbacks are actually still illegal. So what is happening on the Polish border is still illegal, but then it's the European Union, it needs these sort of border states to, you know, absorb you know, absorb this kind of like culpability in a way, because actually, you know, it is what the EU has been doing in the last 5 years. It's been turning a blind eye to these pushbacks. And now, you know, it looks like there will be actual, like, a judicial framework to allow for them anyway. So basically, you know, the sort of post-war consensus post-war sort of refugee understanding of the refugee is actually probably going to disappear very soon. And I don't think we're ever going to be pretending anymore that we're going to be allowing people to apply for asylum. So when we're reporting out about it, we have to remember that it was only when the geopolitical situation started to get really testy between Belarus and Poland, that, you know, Merkel and Macron started to intervene and had talks with Lukashenko and Putin. So that was their involvement to sort of like de-escalate the geopolitical issue. But otherwise, you know, Merkel even publicly said that she was happy with the work that Poland was doing. Final last words, which is such a turnaround, obviously, after 2015. I think, you know, the European Union is pretty happy with what they've been doing on the border. And if nothing else, and I mean, maybe this is just my being cynical, like, you know, then the European Union doesn't get flack for it, right? It's Poland that gets flack for it.
Which probably came as a surprise to some kind of, you know, anti-government Polish liberals, where the EU is often seen as a kind of bastion of progressive values, right? We see kind of EU flags regularly on anti-government protests. But here, we certainly had a kind of unholy alliance of Eurosceptic nationalists and EU technocrats agreeing on this, right? That kind of desperate people don't deserve support.
Yeah, I think it's one of those frequent, uncomfortable truths that the liberals have to deal with when it comes to the European Union, that it's not just a good place. It's not just espousing great values all the time.
But then obviously the British government also played its part. You know, the British government, led by hardcore Brexit supporters, also offered Poland military support straight away, right?
That was interesting. And it was interesting because it was right at the peak of everything, where I think, you know, you had the Times, because I was writing for the Times at that time, and a few other newspapers that were like, British troops go to the border, and then the Guardian was like, 10 British troops or a dozen British troops were sent to the border. And this is also like another thing that's like, when you're trying to de-escalate a war, maybe just don't do anything along the military presence line. Like, I mean, I'm not a military strategist. I don't know anything about escalate a war, but I do think the more you talk about war, the more possibility there is that war will emerge. No, everyone had to have their, you know, like, little piece of the symbolic pie, right?
I mean, yeah, like, it doesn't feel like it was this big military operation, right? It was more a matter of symbolically showing from one right-wing nationalist government to the other that's on the same side.
Because you got this, I think, around exactly this same time, you had that horrible situation in the Channel, right, where you had that sort of that standoff between France and the UK. Is that correct?
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of parallels what you were saying, right? The government in the UK distracting from the cost of living crisis or the many crises by ramping up this fear of people arriving in the UK on boats.
Well, COVID. I mean, I don't even know why I'm only talking about inflation. Like, COVID. Both of our countries, they've been messing around with COVID a lot, right, on a symbolic and rhetorical level. So, absolutely, that's been one of the distractions.
Yeah, no, totally. There's a lot of parallels there. My final question was, if people want to support Grupa Granica, Fundacja Ocalenie, all these groups kind of operating on the border, is the best way to do that donating money?
I think so, yeah, because they know what they're doing. Donating money, I guess people are delivering goods still, but I think money's always the best, but especially if you're not in Poland, right? The infrastructure they've built around this is just phenomenal. So
I will be linking to these groups and the relevant fundraisers on a Twitter account. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paulina. And thank you to everyone who patiently listened to my first demo podcasting. Oh my God, it still feels so awkward. I hope you found this conversation as interesting and informative as I did. If you did, please subscribe. Please follow us on Twitter and Instagram at the podcast, so the K, and recommend it to your friends. And if you have an interesting story to tell or an issue you're passionate about that's relevant to the themes of the podcast and you would like to help with an episode and talk about it, please get in touch on social media and let's chat. Meanwhile, I hope you have a good day and I hope you listen again.